Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we search for new and interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week I'm very pleased to say we will be talking to Pasan Parthasarathy about his book, Why Europe Grew Rich and Asia Did Not, Global Economic Divergence, 1600 to 1850. I have read a lot of books that try to explain why Europe grew rich and Asia did not. I love the title of this book. It's completely telegraphic. That's one of its great virtues. The whole book is telegraphic. But I confess, after reading all these books, I do not know. I do not know. But I think after reading Pasan's book, I have a better idea of why Europe grew rich and Asia did not. This is obviously an extraordinarily big question and touchy in many ways, and I think that Pasan does a very good job of explaining why these two areas of the world, really more than two areas of the world, ended up in different states. And he does so in a very neutral, and I think, I don't know if I should say this word or not, scientific. Can I say that, Pasan? Scientific fashion? Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, because he has a thesis. Lordy, lordy, he has a thesis, and the thesis is either wrong or right, and he musters evidence to show that the thesis is right. And that's a very great virtue of this book, too. So, Pasan, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Marshall.
All right. So, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm from India, as many of our listeners can probably deduce from my name. But I came to the United States as a child. My father worked at the World Bank. So my family moved to Washington, D.C., and I spent a lot of summers in India and kind of going back and forth under the stark differences in income and wealth were always something that I kind of puzzled over. And as a college student, I was an undergraduate at Williams College. I was actually starting to study chemistry. As a sophomore, I spent a semester taking a class on the writings of Karl Marx, and that kind of changed my direction, and I majored in economics. And then I ended up in a PhD program in economics at Harvard, where I started thinking about these questions a little more intensively. And so my training is actually in economics, which may account for the description of my book as scientific. So I think I
meant that in a totally good way.
No, I know, but I think I have a pretty kind of strong training in analytic, strong analytic training, we could call it. During when I was doing my PhD, I was a student of David Landis's, and I picked a thesis topic. So my area of research was in economic history. So I picked a thesis topic on 18th century South India, which is the region of India that I'm from. And it was a study of the textile industry and weavers and merchants. And I picked this topic really because I thought it could shed light on two questions that I was interested in most. One was, what was the impact of the rise of British rule in India? And the second was, I thought that a study of textile manufacturing in the region of India would help me shed light on this problem of why Europe grew rich and Asia did not. So that's when I started thinking about these questions. But in the thesis itself, I really focused on just the nature of colonialism and its impact, and left the second question for later, which I picked up about 10, 12 years ago, doing the research and writing, and it culminated in this book.
Mm-hmm. I like two things that you said. One is the introduction to the topic via Marx. This happened to me too. Mm-hmm. I was going to be a doctor, and then I kind of read Marx, and I was like, you know, this is some really interesting questions this guy asks.
It's fascinating stuff. Yeah. The power of that man's mind.
Yeah, no, incredible. He asked all the right questions.
Yeah.
I don't know if his answers were right, but he asked all the right questions. And then you mentioned David Landis. I used to actually teach with David Landis, and I think that our listeners would be interested to know that David Landis wrote perhaps the most famous of these books. Tries to describe why Europe and not other places. And I think it's called Prometheus Unbound. Is that right? Unbound Prometheus. That's what it's called.
Yeah, Unbound Prometheus.
Is one of them.
Is one of them. And then later he wrote a more popular book that explicitly addressed global questions, the wealth and poverty of nations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was published in the late 1990s.
Yeah, so he really is the godfather of many of these books. And so it's interesting that you studied with him.
Yes.
And I can remember certain interactions with David Landis while I was teaching there at Harvard, especially with the undergraduates who came there. This was a long time ago, and they came there of a more or less socialist bent.
Mm-hmm.
David Landis would not have any of it.
Was this in this historical study?
Yeah, that's right. It was in social studies. Studies. Yeah, I taught with him there. And he would be brought in to give lectures about, because we would read Weber and Marx and these other things, and he would come and give lectures about the history of capitalism. And his history of capitalism is very different than Marx's. And we read Marx too, of course, many of the students there, and I would say this is true of me as an early undergraduate, were rather critical of capitalism as such and didn't really like what Landis had to say about it. And so it was a very interesting experience for me. I'm not taking sides here. I just remember Landis as being kind of an oversized character. He's a big personality.
He's a big personality, and he's a really major historian.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
The post-war U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the post-war U.S. Yeah, so
let me – you kind of answered the question, but let me ask it in more detail. Why did you write this book? I mean, this is a this is the kind of book that one hesitates to write, particularly a young scholar. It's a big book. And sorry, I'm sort of interested in why you took up the task.
Well, as I said before, I think being from India and spending a lot of time both in the U.S. and in India, it's the kind of question that looms large in one's thinking. But then also focusing in South Asian history, and since the late 70s, there's been a growing body of research on 17th and 18th century South Asia that has been drawing parallels in the nature of political, economic development between different regions in South Asia and those that seem thought to be exceptional in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So things like growing commercial activity, growing money use, the emergence of rationality that was associated with greater sophistication of commercial activity, kind of state centralization, proto-bureaucratization, a number of things that were seen as uniquely European, while India was kind of caught in either kind of oriental despotism or a kind of static situation or chaotic decline. All of these previous dichotomies of Europe and India really didn't hold any water. So if all of these ways in which Europe was thought to be different was no longer tenable, then how can we explain this divergence?
Mm-hmm.
Because these exceptional developments in Europe were thought to be the reason for say, European industrialization and so on. So it really was a coming together of these two points. And some of my work on these comparative questions actually began right after I finished my PhD, which I finished in 1992. And I thought, let me see if I can get a quick publication from my research on weavers in South India. And so I thought, South Asia in the 17th and 18th centuries was a huge exporting region, an exporter of manufactured goods, the most important being cotton textiles. So since the late 17th century, the received wisdom on why these cotton textiles from India were so competitive in markets around the world, its competitiveness was attributed to the cheapness of Indian labor. And one of the things that I found in my dissertation is that if you look at weavers in South India in the 18th century, and they were in an incredibly strong bargaining position and received very favorable contracts from merchants to whom they supplied cloth and so on. So this argument about the cheapness of Indian labor didn't hold any water, I thought. So I did a very rough comparison of kind of the weekly earnings of weavers, also spinners and laborers in agriculture in the mid-18th century, comparing South India with Britain. And Britain at the time was considered to have the highest wages in Europe. And what I found was that actually the in real terms, so converting these weekly money earnings into the quantity of grain that could be purchased, what I found was that these real living standards, very roughly calculated, were comparable between Britain and South India, which really runs counter to a long-standing received wisdom. So this I published in 1998, and then this kind of sparked my further research on these questions.
I see. Well, one of the things I really like about the book, and I called it scientific, is that it's a good example of the way that science is supposed to work. We had a hypothesis about Europe and Asia. The part of it that concerned Asia did not rest on firm empirical foundations. Due to a lot of reasons, American academia started to produce people that studied South Asia intensively and basically with Western methods. And what we discovered was what we knew about South Asia was wrong. So we had to go back to the hypothesis and change it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it's supposed to work, right?
Well, in theory, in the best of all worlds, history is a kind of theoretical discipline that is tempered by empirical material as well.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Evidence is often very hard to interpret as well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. That's
so
true.
There are lots of debates about how to interpret certain pieces of evidence.
Right.
But I think on the whole, some of these previous assumptions about European difference just don't hold so much water anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that I've, you know, obviously it's interesting. I'd be interested to see how your book is received and other books like this that say something kind of similar by the people that wrote these earlier books. I mean, my impression is that they're sort of fair-minded people, and they'll say, well, we didn't know that, so I didn't know that, so I was wrong, and he's right. And, you know, that is, you know, and kudos to those people for saying that, because that exactly is the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah,
so good. So let's actually talk about the thesis of the book, and let's set the stage a little bit. Europe in the 18th century and India, which is your primary comparison in the 18th century. And you, I should say, focus on a couple of particular areas, if I recall correctly. One is Britain, and then in the Indian case, you focus on Gujarat, which is in the west, and then Bengal, which is in the east. Is that right? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Again, I'm one of those people that doesn't know anything about India. So I'm wrong about everything.
Well, no, you've been right so far about all things on India.
Right, so these are your comparisons, yeah.
I focus a little bit on Gujarat. I mean, in the 18th century, there were half a dozen or so really highly commercialized big exporting regions in India. So Gujarat in the west was one of them. But there's been less research done on Gujarat in the 17th and 18th century. Another one was in the east, Bengal, and there's been quite a lot done on Bengal. So I draw on quite a bit of evidence from Bengal in my book, and also my own area, which is South India, southeastern India in the 18th century. So it's, so I try to focus on Bengal and South India as much as possible, but for some pieces of evidence were not available for those two regions, so sometimes I go into northern India, into Gujarat, for some kinds of comparisons that I'm interested in making in the book.
Mm-hmm. And the industry that you focus on particularly is one that was very important in the 18th century, we know that, and that is the textile industry, and particularly cotton, the making of cotton thread, and then its production into cloth of various kinds, right?
Yeah. Textiles were the most important manufactured good in the world until sometime in the 19th century, maybe even the 20th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're a manufactured good. They're pretty easy to transport. They're universally necessary.
Yeah.
And cotton is so much better than anything else.
Yeah. Available. And of those, in global trade, cotton was the most important. And going back quite a long time.
Yeah.
So, and until the 19th century, the main source of cotton textiles to the global economy was India.
Uh-huh, that's right.
So we're talking about a situation before the 19th century in which these cotton manufacturing regions in India were really major centers in this global economic order.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it really, one of the things the book tries to do is really shift our attention from thinking about the global economy in the 18th century or even in the 17th century as something that's really centered in Europe or Northwestern Europe,
mm-hmm.
and argues for the importance of some of these Indian regions in world trade.
Mm-hmm. So let's come right to the thesis of the book. And as I say, it's very distinct. It's very telegraphic. Can you state it? And it concerns this, just to lead you a little bit. It concerns the problem that British tradesmen and I guess manufacturers in textiles faced,
mm-hmm.
when they saw the import of Indian cotton.
Yes.
So go ahead and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, let me take a step back from the British textile manufacturers to thinking about how we even conceptualize the problem, because I think that's an important intervention that I make with the book, which is that previous writings on the problem of economic divergence have tried to identify some way in which Europe or Europeans were different from Chinese or Indians or West Asians, and then divergence is attributed to that difference. So Europeans they had a kind of rationality that Europeans and Chinese did not have, or they had capitalism, or they had a kind of scientific culture. So this is how the problem has been, or the answers to this question have been structured until now. And what I argue is that this is an anachronistic way to structure the problem, because we can only structure the problem after the fact, once we already know the outcome. But no one in the 17th and 18th centuries was operating or making choices with this outcome in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I argue that to not be anachronistic, we need to really kind of situate ourselves in the 17th and 18th century world. We need to first see that the paths of economic change were plural or multiple, that there were many paths that could be taken. And I argue that we need to see these different paths that were taken across Europe and Asia as really responses to whatever social, political, economic pressures were being felt in those different regions. And if these pressures were systematically different, then it's not surprising that different paths of economic development emerged across this great area of Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So what the book argues is that Europe was subject to two pressures that were not found in any region of India in the 18th century. And the first of these was pressure from global competitive pressures from Indian textile manufacturers. As I said a few minutes ago, these regions in India really dominated the global trade in cotton textiles, the most important manufactured good. One sign of this dominance, besides the fact that so many regions of the world, from Japan, Southeast Asia, the Ottoman Empire, East Africa, West Africa, Europe, and the Americas, all of these regions, now growing evidence is showing we're consuming larger and larger quantities of Indian cotton goods, or, and if cotton, Indian cotton goods were not available, locally made cotton goods. So cotton underwent the kind of consumption revolution in the 17th and 18th centuries. And another sign of India's dominance in this world economy, or importance in this world economy, is that I estimate in the book that about a quarter of the silver that was being was infused into the global economy between 1600 and 1800, much of this from the Americas, but also some from Japan, that about a quarter of the silver ended up in India, mm-hmm. which was then was coined, and it fueled this great commercial revolution. European manufacturers, as well as manufacturers in some other places, including Southeast Asia, the Ottoman Empire, they saw all of these Indian textiles being consumed both locally as well as in other markets around the world, and they started to try to imitate these Indian cotton textiles. And what I argue in the book is that mechanization of spinning in the late 18th century, which is one of the key breakthroughs in textile manufacturing, and closely one of the central elements of the British Industrial Revolution, really emerged out of an attempt to manufacture cotton cloth that could both meet kind of the specifications set by Indian textile manufacturers, the kind of quality cloth that they could manufacture, and that could compete with Indian goods in markets around the world. Mm-hmm. So it was that pressure that led to this Western European response. I mean, it first really emerges in Britain, but you have textile manufacturers in other parts of Europe as well. And there's growing evidence for this from France, trying to figure out how they can outcompete Indian goods and Indian textile workers. So this is a pressure that was not felt in India because they were dominant in this textile, global textile trade. So that was the first of these two pressures that led to this European response that then put Europe on the on a path of greater and greater production using machinery. The second pressure that the book takes up, cotton is extremely important in my mind, but the mechanization of spinning and then some subsequent innovations in textile manufacturing, I think it, in global terms, it's a very important part of this divergence between Europe and Asia, because the center of the world's textile manufacturing from the late 18th century shifted out of South Asia or India into Western Europe. Mm-hmm. So from the early 19th century, Britain really becomes the major supplier to the world of cotton textiles. Mm-hmm. So this is a dramatic transformation of global economic relations, a different path of development. But that alone, I argue in the book, would have produced a rather, an important economic transformation in Europe, but cannot explain fully in some of the developments before the mid-19th century. And to understand some of these other developments that were centered around energy, the increasing use of coal, which then made possible, once coal started to be put to work in smelting iron, and once the steam engine started to be perfected, a new kind of energy economy emerges, which I think is critical to understanding this, the European path. And that, I argue, using my framework of differential pressures, what you have in especially in Britain very early, is tremendous shortages of wood, which lead to experimentation with coal that lasts for several hundred years, culminating in the 18th century with important technological breakthroughs. But if you look at the advanced regions of India, it's Bengal or South India, or even the heartland of northern India, the heartland of the Mughal Empire in the 17th century, what you find is abundant forested areas. Mm-hmm. So there isn't the same kind of ecological pressure that in Britain gives rise to the search for new kinds of energy substitutes that produces this tremendous coal revolution. In India, you have abundant forested areas well into the 19th and even 20th century. Mm-hmm. So the context is really different. But in Britain, with this experimentation in coal, which begins in the medieval period, it slowly accelerates. And by the 18th century, it's the increasing use of coal is closely linked to advances in the steam engine because of the poor efficiency of steam engines. The one place where they can be used very effectively is at mine heads, where you have plentiful, and especially coal mines, where you have plentiful supplies of coal. And so the development of the steam engine is closely linked to coal, the exploitation of coal. And then coal is used for the smelting of iron. So iron prices suddenly plummet. So you, by the early 19th century, so by the 1830s, 1840s, this new energy economy really starts to build up steam in Britain, but closely linked to a longstanding ecological crisis in Britain is the argument of the book that had no counterpart in India.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's the larger kind of argument. And the third leg of this argument, which I think is really, really important, and is the centrality of state policy. And I think we need to see the British state in the 17th and 18th centuries as really a mercantilist state, which is trying to build up the economy as a way to build up state power. So the state plays a very important role, sometimes unintentionally, and other times quite deliberately, in building up capacity in both textile manufacturing as well as in the exploitation of coal. So in the case of textile manufacturing, Indian cottons, or the import of Indian cottons into Britain starts to be restricted from about 1700, and the kinds of restrictions that are placed on Indian cottons lead to new kinds of cotton textile activity in Britain. And so it's really interesting. You can see, you can track the development of the cotton industry in 18th century Britain very closely to state policies from 1700 on. So British textile manufacturers have a protected market in which they really experiment with cotton manufacturing and trying to supply this growing local demand for cotton goods. And it takes 70-odd years to really finally be able to outcompete India. So this is not an immediate process. So an economic change is often a very slow and long-term process. And with coal, I argue in the book that the British state was extremely interested in encouraging and protecting coal, which it did in a number of ways. Coal was really important for maintaining the peace of London, the coal trade from Newcastle. So the British state played an important role in protecting and preserving that trade. The British state helped or to encourage the replacement of charcoal with coal by placing really high tariffs on imports of iron in the 18th century, tariffs that grew steadily over the course of the 18th century. So we're really trying to encourage local iron manufacturing for military purposes and to reduce dependence on Swedish and Russian iron, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think economic history, for the most part, is Smithian in its focus, we could say, inspired by the work of Adam Smith, and really wants to privilege the market. But I think the importance of the state needs to really be brought back in mm-hmm. to understand economic change.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly. So this seems to be, and to put it kind of simply, this seems to be a case, a kind of classical case in the economic sense of market entry. That is, there were British entrepreneurs or textile manufacturers who saw an opportunity to outcompete really people who were their brethren, because the British were importing these Indian textiles, and through innovations of various sorts, they found a way to provide the same good at a lower price. And as you say, with the help of the state and tariffs and things like this. Is that a correct characterization, or is that anachronistic?
I think that is a correct characterization. And one of the things that the book argues is that the state is really important, but that doesn't mean that kind of entrepreneurial activity is not important. And if you look at in Britain in the 18th century, and the ingenuity of entrepreneurs and manufacturers and coal miners is really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So, but I think one needs to see the state as providing a very important context mm-hmm. for this entrepreneurial activity to flourish.
Certainly, certainly. So let's actually talk a little bit about the three legs of this argument. I'm going to talk about the first one, and that has to do with weaving technologies, really. Innovation is expensive. It's really hard to buy. I think there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley trying to buy it right now. It's not. Yeah. I don't think you can just buy it. So I see these British textile manufacturers, and there they are confronted with these Indian textiles that are very high quality, and people seem to love them. And they say, "Well, we have to do better than this." Why didn't they just do what the Indians did? I mean, how did the Indians produce it, and why didn't the British just say, well, you know, we have people over there, we have factors, and so we'll just kind of copy the way that they do it, and then we'll produce the same thing?
Well, they did do that for certain things, and they tried to get a lot of information about how Indians dyed cotton cloth, for example, and how they – a lot of this cotton cloth was either – printed with designs or painted. That was one of the things that made them so appealing. And there were attempts to understand the processes by which Indians made these colors fast on the cloth.
It's so funny. I have to interrupt because I was just dropping my daughter off at her her school, and uh-huh. they have a whole set of these sort of printed cotton cloths. They're just completely iconic, and everybody recognizes them as Indian even today. I'm sure they're made in China, but they are.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody recognizes these things.
Yeah, and the printed cotton, I mean, which is so common today. I mean, I'm sitting here wearing a printed cotton shirt. It's not Indian, but it has its origins in this Indian trade in the 17th century, starting in the 17th century.
Very attractive stuff, very attractive. So you said they did actually ape these techniques, but why not the whole production process, I guess is what I mean. I mean, why didn't they just say, you know, in the way that Chinese manufacturers do, and I know Russian manufacturers did. Does this borrow the whole factory? We'll bring it over here and we'll just produce it here.
You know, the main problem that they face, I mean, they did at certain points sort of bring Indian weavers to Britain. There were experiments in France bringing over Indian weavers. And they didn't really go anywhere. The major problem in the 18th century that these European textile manufacturers faced was really spinning yarn that was strong enough to be stretched on the loom as the warp. Hmm. So those were the... Mm-hmm. And they did try to figure out... They made inquiries about how Indians spun the yarn and so on. But it never really went anywhere. And I can't answer this question. Mm-hmm. And why it is that European spinners found it so difficult to spin this cotton strong enough to be used in the loom.
Mm-hmm.
But there were lots of inquiries. I mean, so studies and of what how Indians did it, but it couldn't be. It wasn't able to be translated into the European context.
Mm-hmm. And this is a particularly unusual thing. I remember in the 19. Does anybody remember the 1980s anymore when Japan was going to dominate the world? Do you remember?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember that? now China is going to dominate the world. We're very bad at picking the country of the future.
I mean, I remember with the Japan stuff, there was all this talk about, just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah, right. We're going to do it just like they do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that it's not so easy just to kind of take something from one place and just pop it down somewhere else.
No, it's quite difficult. Yeah, I think the whole history of the Soviet Union demonstrates that. And I say that as a Russian historian. So anyway, they could not reproduce the way in which these cotton textiles were produced in India. So then you say they sought alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
But the alternatives they sought are kind of unusual, mechanical production of these things. Where did they get the idea to produce mechanical looms?
Well, it starts really with spinning.
Yeah.
It was really the application of roller processes. So if you have a roller turning, that somehow if we can apply pressure, we can draw out a yarn.
Yeah.
So... and some of this roller technology was even applied to cloth printing in the 18th century. And you can see also the application of techniques used in spinning wool yarn
mm-hmm.
into cotton in Britain in the 18th century. So things like using cards, so kind of rough brushes to put the wool fibers parallel to prepare them for spinning, starts to be applied to cotton spinning, or to prepare cotton, raw cotton for spinning, which is something that's not done in India at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of uses of different kinds of techniques that were in existence in Britain and applying them to the task of cotton.
Mm-hmm. So here we have kind of a classic example of technology transfer and tinkering.
Exactly.
This sort of thing was in their environment. They knew about it in another context, and they thought it might be able to be adapted to the production of cotton thread.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it turned out that they could produce it actually quite inexpensively compared to cotton thread imported from India.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then we come to the more complicated thing, which is actually the mechanical loom. And these things are so complicated, I don't even understand them. They really are pretty bizarrely complicated.
Yeah, well, it starts just with the fly shuttle.
Yeah.
So with something that, instead of having to have two people, especially in very broadcloth, that throw the shuttle back and forth to send warp yarns back and forth, being able to hit something on the side that can send the shuttle back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where it begins. And then then subsequently in the late 18th, early 19th century, that becomes mechanized.
Yeah. And then it becomes mechanically powered, and then we come to the story of wood and coal. So originally, I don't know what originally means in history, but originally were these things mechanically powered by wood fired steam engines, or how were they powered? Were they powered by water?
Well, a lot of the early power in Lancashire was water power.
Mm-hmm.
And even, say, in the U.S. as well, in textile manufacturing. And in the U.S., water power becomes really the staple source of power and remains that for a longer time than in Britain.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but you went to Williams. So, I mean, I'm in Northampton right now. And,
mm-hmm.
and this area of New England, how this economy works now, I don't know. I don't really understand what anybody does here, but there are mills everywhere. There are water mills everywhere. So this was really how it was done in the 18th century, was with water mills. Yeah.
Yeah, and even into the 19th century in New England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in Britain, you have some use of steam power in the early 19th century, but in textile manufacturing in Lancashire, but it really takes off from the 1840s. for a variety of reasons. Some of it having to do with once the 10-hour day is enacted, then mill owners, they need to speed up their machines. Mm-hmm. And the way that they can do that is with installing steam power, mm-hmm. as opposed to water power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So one of the arguments of the book is that it's really steam power becomes really central to cotton manufacturing quite late in the day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of distinguish between innovations in cotton and the energy revolution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how does coal begin to be used in this context? And why, again, you say that England was deforested. Mm-hmm. People who've been to England will know that.
Yeah.
And actually, it's interesting about this part of New England. Most people don't realize this or not, but the area around Williams College, for example, and certainly Northampton in the 18th century would have been completely barren because it was mm-hmm. all cropped. So there were no forests here. They had cut them all down.
Yeah.
And now it's all forest.
So you have a tremendous revival.
Yeah, exactly.
Of forest in the 19th century.
Right. They cut everything.
In New England.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So England is deforested. They need to turn to another fuel source. How did they come upon coal?
Well, coal is really abundant, found in lots of parts of England and Wales and even in Scotland. It's in some places found pretty close to the surface. So when you find this stuff, I mean, at some quite early point, I don't know exactly when, and you have people in the British Isles kind of experimenting with coal.
My guess would be, you know, they burnt peat a lot. I know I lived in Ireland for a while. They still burn it. And peat is basically something that's about to become coal. At least that's my impression.
Yeah. So it is a fossil fuel, but it's
has not
reached that stage yet. So it contains less energy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of coal use, even into the 19th century, was for domestic purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for heating homes and for cooking.
Yeah.
So that was really a very important big market, and this is where you could do a lot of innovation.
Right. Mm-hmm. A lot of houses in New England have coal chutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there you go.
And then, so gradually, coal starts to be experimented with for manufacturing processes of various kinds. So glass making and brewing beer, where you need to heat up water. So it was a long process of kind of trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this knowledge was really held in the hands and minds of the people who worked with the coal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the interesting things about 18th century Europe is that in Britain itself, which is where in Europe you had the most knowledge of coal, there were very few works written about coal, whereas in Germany, where there was much less knowledge about coal, you have many more publications about coal. So, and this is a sign that the Germans are trying to understand how to use this coal and trying to propagate this knowledge. Whereas in Britain, it was kind of developed organically through the coal workers themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then once these techniques spread in the textile industry, and once coal fired steam engines in this case, or cold-fired production, that would include things like heating up water and things like this for the production of beer, let's say. Once that is initiated, then other entrepreneurs in the English context begin to see that it is a very economical way to do things, and they basically adopt these technologies. Is that the argument?
Well, these technologies do diffuse,
mm-hmm.
And more people start experimenting with coal and different new kinds of processes and come up with new innovations, and culminating really with the substitution of coal or coke for charcoal mm-hmm. in iron smelting, which mm-hmm. is a really major breakthrough.
Right, exactly. So let's look at the other side of the equation. So the Indians, I don't really like this phrase, because I think one thing people don't understand is this when we talk about a place like Gujarat or a place like Bengal, these are enormous places.
Mm-hmm.
They're just enormous. They're not, and so it would be like talking about Europe and then one part of it England, India,
yeah.
One part of it Gujarat. It's really mm-hmm. a big place. So they were really the first to understand how to produce these textiles efficiently enough to export them into the British market, and the British sort of cooked their own goose in that way because they started this export industry, again entrepreneurship. Did the Indian manufacturers of these things, obviously they sensed that their export industry was collapsing. Why didn't they attempt to borrow what the English had used in order to make their goods yet more inexpensive and then re-export them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do start doing it from the 1850s and in Bombay, which is one of the big centers of cotton manufacturing in the new mill framework. Bombay begins in the 1850s. But earlier than that, before that, it's a slow process of change. I mean, it's not something that happens all of a sudden. And you have, you had multiple markets that were the Indian manufacturers and merchants were trading and sending goods. So I think as sort of some of these markets in the Atlantic world started to evaporate, then Indian manufacturers started sending to some other markets in East Africa or in the Middle East. As Middle East markets begin to evaporate, and you still have the vast domestic market. And I think, so it wasn't a kind of a sudden process of the elimination of these markets. And so it took place over several decades. I think the other important piece of it is that one of the things that the book argues is that one of the sources of important sources of dynamism in the 18th century South Asian context is really the state.
Mm-hmm.
And in 18th century South Asia, you have a lot of regional state building going on. So you have quite a bit of innovation in things like armaments, manufacturing, and metallurgy. And states also beginning to realize that they need to try to build up local manufacturing capacity in order to expand their revenue base and be able to compete politically and militarily. And I think the elimination of the state, or the Indian state system, we could say, and the establishment of British colonial rule. I mean, the British colonial state was not interested in Indian manufacturers forging a response to this new global condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were explicitly trying to expand markets for British made goods in India itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the gradualness of the shift combined with this new political context.
Mm-hmm.
To really respond to a lot of seismic shifts in the global economy, I think you need to have the state has to play an important role, and you see the state in places like France and Belgium really playing a very important role in trying to respond to this new kind of manufacturing and industrial capacity that emerges in Britain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we're running out of time, but there are a couple of questions I want to ask you, and it's really about things that you haven't said
mm-hmm.
that are often said in this context. And you kind of touched on one of them, and that is there's some people that argue that imperialism had a lot to do with the failure. Is that the right word? I don't know. The failure of these other areas, non-European areas of the world, to respond industrially to the European threat. But you, in your book, that doesn't really play a very great role.
Well, it does at the end. I think imperialism is a very important dimension, especially in the Indian case, where in the 18th century you have a really sophisticated economic order and a sophisticated knowledge order is what I argue in the book, in terms of artisanal skill and knowledge and so on. And this really gets dismantled in the 19th century as India opened up as a market for British exports. There's less need for local armaments manufacturing because this new British Indian Army is supplied from with weapons from manufactured in Britain. So metallurgical skills begin to decline and disappear. So there's a process of de-skilling that in 19th century India, which I think is intimately connected to its status as a colony.
I mean, I certainly understand that. I'm thinking of the parallel case being, you mentioned that the British were promoting manufacturers in their colonies in the 18th century. They certainly did that in the New World as well. I know that because I have just renovated an 18th century house, and I noticed that a lot of the finished goods were from England. And I read about this, and that's because the English mandated that finished goods had to be brought from England. They couldn't be manufactured in the colonies. No wonder they revolted. You can't make a doorknob or a latch. Right.
So this is the Birmingham toy trade.
Yeah, exactly. They were very interested in this. So that's certainly correct. And I certainly understand the de-skilling part of it as well. But I guess what I was speaking to was the kind of thesis that the imperial powers went into these areas in order to extract labor and unfinished goods, and full stop. That's what they were about. That's not really the story that you tell.
No, I mean, I think that dimension, I think, becomes really much more important later in the 19th century in the Indian case.
Yeah,
I mean, starting say sort of near the end of where my book leaves off, in the say 1830s, 1840s. And you do have it, say, even in the late 18th century. I mean, these early muslin manufacturers in Britain in the late 1780s sit down to have meetings with the East India Company, which is still importing muslins from India. And they, in their conversations, the muslin manufacturers who still feel threatened by these Indian muslins and the competition of those muslins say to the East India Company, you know, what you should do is import cotton from India, which we can use, and then we can try to export muslins from here to India, and everybody will both we'll be better off and Indians will be better off from this. So you do have some of this thinking, but I think it's more in terms of particular commodities rather than a kind of big imperial vision of let's make this place an exporter of raw materials. I mean, that's the structure that emerges, but the process by which it emerges is more complicated, more uneven, and slower.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that imperialism doesn't play any role in your book. It absolutely does. It's just a more subtle view of it than the kind of let's go in gunboats and rob them version. So another thing that is not mentioned very much in the book is and this you see a lot of this as well, cultural differences. You're not really excited about those as explanatory variables.
No, I'm not, and I'm not saying that every place is the same, but I for some of these kind of key economic topics, we can say, I mean, kind of trade, kind of accumulating capital, banking. You can certainly, in the way Indians organize some of these things in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and even 20th and today centuries and today, are radically different from the way Europeans may have organized them. Drawing on relations of kinship and caste and even sometimes beyond that and so on. But it's these in terms of their effectiveness, they're comparable, I would say. So there isn't, there are cultural differences, but I'm not convinced that these cultural differences lead to radically different kinds of economic performance, can say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in many of these cases, the the techniques which are necessary in order to create a market and then produce goods for that market and sell in that market can be very culturally variable. But you know, when one place is producing textiles for X and another place is producing textiles for X minus six, the people who are producing it for X have a real problem. And that's simply a universal, and they're going to have to find a way to produce it for X minus six.
Or
they're going to go out of business in a free. This is sort of beyond culture. You really need to do this thing. And the mechanisms which are available, I mean, one of the things you mentioned is banking techniques, and they are they're variable throughout the world. I mean, you think in the Islamic world, it's done actually quite differently, but it has the same effect. Capital goes where it's supposed to go.
I mean, I think in terms of their kind of, we could say their allocative efficiency. I'm not convinced that there are radical differences.
And I find that very interesting because, you know, where the rubber meets the road in competition in things like commodities is how cheaply they are produced and distributed. That's really the end of the story. I don't know what else there is to say. I mean, we can see that in the world economy today. I mean, the fact of the matter is the Chinese are producing things a lot more cheaply than we can. So we buy everything from them.
You know?
And our problem is we have to find out other things. We have to find things that they want, or we have to find how to produce things more cheaply than they do. Those are our only two choices. You know, culture aside, they may like American Idol or not. I don't know. But it doesn't matter.
So this is a kind of constant economic issue, we could say.
In terms of competitive economies, that's right. It's a fascinating book, and I want to thank you very much for writing it. It's very, very interesting and well argued, and it's, as I say, that the thesis is telegraphic, and I think can be picked up by anybody. And so I want to thank you for writing it. We've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to take these last few minutes to ask you our traditional final question on new books in history, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, as a consequence of writing this book, I've become really interested in environmental history. So my current project is in environmental history of 19th and possibly 20th century South India. So I'm really thinking broadly about the biosphere, water, forests, grasslands, and how and this biosphere has really radically changed in the last 150, 200 years. So I think what has been the impact on human well-being of this dramatic reshaping of our of the South Indian environment is what I'm working on now. And I'll be going off to South India in about a month.
Great. Well, that's good. Congratulations on that, and good luck with the work.
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening in to this podcast. We've been talking with Prasan Parthasarathi about his book, Why Europe Grew Rich and Asia Did Not, A Global Economic Divergence, 1600 to 1850. So thanks, everybody, for listening. But I especially want to thank Prasan for talking with us today. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Marshall. It's really been a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.